to Winter, questioningly, and for the first time in his lonely life feels a touching of minds. There are no words. Winter's gentle poet's face enters with a promise of strength and friendship. The fragile muscles on Serbitar's skeletal body begin to shake as an infusion of power regenerates wasted cells. "What is the matter with the boy?" Drada's voice fills with alarm.
"Nothing. Say farewell to your son."
The red-bearded warrior turns his horse's head to the north and gazes down at the white-haired child. "Do as you're told. Be good." He hesitates, pretends his horse is skittish. He is trying to find words for a final farewell, but he cannot. Always he has found difficulty with this red-eyed child. "Be good," he says again, then raises an arm and leads his men northward on the long journey home. As the wagon pulls away, bright sunlight streams onto the pallet, and the boy reacts as if lanced. His face mirrors pain, his eyes squeeze shut. Winter gently seeks his mind and pulses. "Stand now, and follow the pictures I will place on your eyelids." At once the pain eases, and the boy can see more clearly than ever before. And his muscles lift him at last, a sensation he thought he had forgotten since a year ago when he collapsed in the snow of the Delnok Mountains. From that moment to this, he has lain paralyzed, unspeaking. Now he stands, and with eyes tight shut, he sees more clearly. Without guilt, he realizes he has forgotten his father, and is happy for it. The spirit of the older Serbitar tastes again the total joy which flooded the youth that day, as, arm in arm with Fintar the soul, he walked across the courtyard until at last, in a bright-lit corner, they came to a tiny rose-cutting nestling by a high stone wall. "This is your rose, Serbitar. Love it, cherish it, and grow with it. One day a flower will form on that tiny plant, and its fragrance will be for you alone."
"Is it a white rose?"
"It is whatever you will it to be." And through the years that followed, Serbitar found peace and joy in comradeship, but never more than the experience of true commitment with Winter the soul on that first day. Winter had taught him to recognize the herb Loracium and eat of its leaves. At first they had made him drowsy and filled his mind with colors. But as the days passed, his powerful young mind mastered the visions, and the green juices had strengthened his weak blood. Even his eyes changed color to reflect the power of the plant. And he learned to run again, savoring the joy of the wind in his face, to climb and wrestle, to laugh and live. And he had learned to speak without speaking, move without moving, and see without seeing. Through all these blissful years, Serbitar's rose had blossomed and grown. A white rose. And now it had all come to this. One glimpse into the future had destroyed 13 years of training and belief. One speeding shaft, viewed through the mists of time, had changed his destiny. Serbitar had stared horror-struck at the scene below him, on the battle-scarred walls of the Dross. His mind had recoiled from the violence he saw there, and he had fled, comet-swift, to a far corner of a distant universe, losing himself and his sanity among exploding stars and new suns birthing. And still Winter had found him. "You must return."
"I cannot. I have seen."
"As have I."
"Then you know that I would rather die than see it again."
"But you must, for it is your destiny."
"Then I refuse my destiny."
"And your friends, do you refuse them also?"
"I cannot watch you die again, Winter."
"Why not? I myself have seen the scene 100 times. I have even written a poem about it."
"As we are now, shall we be again?" after death? Free souls?
I do not know, but I would have it so. Now, return to your duty. I have pulsed the 30. They will keep your body alive for as long as they can.
They always have. Why should I be the last to die?
Because we would have it so. We love you, Serbitar, and always have. A shy child you were, who had never tasted friendship. Suspicious you were of the slightest touch or embrace. A soul crying alone in a cosmic wilderness. Even now you are alone.
But I love you all,
because you need our love.
Not so, Vintar. Do you love Rek and Virai? They are not of the 30.
Neither were you, until we made it so. And Serbitar had returned to the fortress and felt ashamed. But the shame he had felt earlier was as nothing compared with the feeling he now experienced. Was it but an hour since that he had walked the ramparts with Vintar and complained of many things and confessed to many sins?
You are wrong, Serbitar, so wrong.
I also feel bloodlust in battle. Who does not? Ask Abadak or Menahem. While we are still men, we will feel as other men do.
Then is it for nothing that we are priests? Cried Serbitar. We have spent years of our lives studying the insanity of war, man's lust for power, his need for bloodshed. We raise ourselves above the common man with powers that are almost godlike. Yet in the final analysis we come to this, lusting after battle and death. It is for nothing.
Your conceit is colossal, Serbitar, said Vintar, an edge to his voice, and the suggestion of anger showing in his eyes. You speak of godlike? You speak of the common man? Where, in your words, is the humility we strive for? When you first came to the temple, you were weak and lonely, and several years the youngest. But you learned the more swiftly, and you were chosen as the voice. Did you only acquire the disciplines and forego the philosophy?
It would appear so, answered Serbitar.
You are wrong again, for in wisdom there is suffering. You are pained not because you disbelieve, but because you believe. Let us return to basics. Why do we travel to a distant war?
To die.
Why do we choose this method? Why not simply allow ourselves to starve?
Because in war a man's will to live is strongest. He will fight hard to stay alive. He will learn again to love life.
And what will that force us to face?
Our doubts, whispered Serbitar.
But you never thought that such doubt would come to you. So sure were you of your godlike powers?
Yes, I was sure. No, I am not. Is this such a great sin?
You know it is not. Why am I alive, my boy? Why did I not die with Magnar's 30 2 decades ago?
You were the one chosen to found the new temple. Why was I chosen? You were the most perfect. It has to be so. Then why was I not the leader?
I do not understand you.
How is the leader chosen?
I know not. You have never said.
Then guess, Serbitar.
Because he is the best choice, the most
perfect?
I would have said so, but I see where you are leading. If you were the most perfect, why did Magnar lead?
Well, why did he?
You have seen the future. You should have seen and heard this conversation. You tell me.
You know that I did not, said Serbitar. There was no time for study of the minutiae.
Oh, Serbitar, still you will not understand. What you saw and chose to examine was the minutiae, the meaningless and the trivial. What does it mean to the history of this planet that this dross falls? How many other castles have fallen throughout the ages? Of what cosmic importance was their failure? How vital are our deaths? Tell me then, my Lord Abbot, how is the leader chosen? Have you not guessed at it, my son? I believe so. Then speak. He is the least perfect of the acolytes, said Serbitar softly, his green eyes searching Vintar's face and begging denial. He is the least perfect, echoed Vintar sadly. But why? Asked Serbitar. So that his task will be the more difficult, the more demanding, to give him the chance to rise and match the position he holds. And I have failed? Not yet, Serbitar. Not yet.
Chapter 24. Day by day, more people left the siege city, piling their possessions onto carts, wagons, or the backs of mules, and forming convoys that snaked their way inland towards the relative security of the Skoda Mountains and the capital beyond. With each departure now, fresh problems faced the defenders. Fighting men had to be seconded to other duties, such as latrine clearance, stores supply, and food preparation. Now the drain on resources came on two fronts. Dross was furious and insisted the gates be closed, the evacuation stopped. Reg pointed out that even more soldiers would then be needed to police the South Road. Then the first disaster of the campaign struck the defenders. On the high day of summer, 10 weeks after the battle began, Musif fell and chaos reigned. The Nadir breached the wall at the center, driving a wedge into the killing ground beyond. The men, threatened with encirclement, fell back and raced for the fire gullies. Running skirmishes began as discipline fled, and two gully bridges collapsed as warriors milled upon them. On Karnia, Wall 3, Rek waited as long as he dared before ordering the gullies lit with flame arrows. Dross, Orin, and Hogun scrambled to safety just as the blaze took. But beyond the gully, more than 800 Drenai warriors battled on hopelessly in tight shield rings, which grew smaller moment by moment. Many on Karnia turned away, unable to bear the sight of their friends' futile battles. Reg stood with fists clenched and watched in despair. The fighting did not last long. Hopelessly outnumbered, the Drenai were engulfed, and the battle song of victory was sung by thousands of tribesmen. They gathered before the flames, chanting, waving blood-stained swords and axes in the air. Few on the walls understood the words, but understanding was unnecessary. The message was primal, the meaning clear. It struck the heart and soul with blistering clarity.
What do they sing? Rek asked Dross, as the old man recovered his breath, following the long rope climb to the ramparts.
It's their glory chant. Nadir we, youth born, blood letters, axe wielders, victors still.
Beyond the fire, tribesmen burst into the field hospital, slaying men in their beds and dragging others out into the sunlight, where they could be seen by their comrades on the wall. Then they were peppered with arrows or slowly dismembered. One was even nailed to the window shutters of the barracks to hang screaming for 2 hours before being disemboweled and beheaded. The Drenai dead, stripped of their weapons and armor, were hurled into the fire gullies, and the stench of burning flesh filled the air and stung the eyes. The evacuation at the south gates became a flood as the city emptied. Soldiers joined in, discarding their weapons and mingling with the crowds. No effort was made to stop them, on Rek's direct order. In a little house near the street of Millers, Mairi tried to comfort the small child sobbing in her arms. The noise in the street outside frightened her as families loaded their possessions onto carts and wagons, tethered with oxen or milk cows. It was pandemonium. Mairi cuddled the child,
crooning a lullaby tune and kissing the tight curls on his head.
"I must go back to the wall," said her husband, a tall young man with dark hair and wide, gentle blue eyes.
How tired he looked, hollow-eyed and gaunt.
"Don't go, Karin," she said, as he strapped his sword belt about his waist.
"Don't go. I must.
Let us leave Del Noch. We have friends in Pyrdal, and you could find work there."
He was not an intuitive man, and he missed the note of desperation in her voice, failed to sense the rising panic behind her eyes.
"Don't let these fools frighten you, Mairi. Dras is still with us, and we will hold Karnia, I promise you."
The sobbing child clutched his mother's dress, soothed by the gentle strength of his father's voice. Too young to understand the words, yet he was comforted by the pitch and tone. The noise outside receded from him, and he slept on his mother's shoulder. But Mairi was older and wiser than the child, and to her the words were just words.
"Listen to me, Karin. I want to leave. Today.
I can't talk now. I must go back. I will see you later. It will be all right."
Leaning forward, he kissed her, then stepped into the chaos of the street. She looked around her, remembering. The chest by the door, a gift from Karin's parents. The chairs made by her uncle, Demas, fashioned with care, like all his work. They had brought the chairs and chest with them 2 years before.
Good years?
Karin was kind, thoughtful, loving. There was so much goodness to him. Easing the child into his cot, she wandered to the small bedroom, shutting the window against the noise. Soon the Nadir would come. The door would be smashed in, and filthy tribesmen would come for her, tearing at her clothing. She shut her eyes. Dras was still here, he had said.
Stupid Karin. Kind, loving, thoughtful, stupid Karin. Karin the miller.
She had never been truly happy with him, though without this war she might never have realized it. She had been so close to contentment. Then he had joined the defenders, coming home so proudly in that ludicrous breastplate and oversized helm.
Stupid Karin. Kind Karin.
The door opened, and she turned to see her friend Delis, her blonde hair covered in a travel shawl and a heavy cloak over her shoulders.
"Are you coming?" she asked. "Yes. Is Karin coming with you?" "No."
Swiftly she gathered her belongings, pushing them into a canvas bag issued to Karin. Delis carried the bag to the wagon outside, while Mairi lifted her son from his cot, wrapping him in a second blanket. Stooping, she pulled open the small chest, pushing aside the linen and pulling clear the small bag of silver which Karin had hidden there. She didn't bother to close the door. In the keep, Dras raged at Rek, swearing to kill any deserter he recognized.
"It's too late for that," said Rek.
"Damn you, boy!" muttered Dras. "We have fewer than 3,000 men. How long do you think we will hold if we allow desertions?"
"How long if we don't?" snapped Rek. "We are finished anyway. Sebitar says Karnia can be held for maybe 2 days. Sumitos, perhaps 3. Valteri the same, and Gedon less. 10 days in all. 10 miserable days."
The young earl leaned on the balcony rail above the gates and watched the convoy start south.
"Look at them, Dras. Farmers, bakers, tradesmen. What right do we have to ask them to die? What will it matter to them if we fail? The Nadir will not kill every baker in Drennan. It will just mean a change of masters."
"You give up too easily," snarled Dras.
"I'm a realist, and don't give me any Skeln Pass lectures. I'm not going anywhere."
"You might as well," said Dras, slumping into a leather chair. "You have already lost hope."
Rek turned from the window, eyes blazing.
"What is it with you warriors? It is understandable that you talk in clichés, but unforgivable if you think in them. Lost hope, indeed. I never had any hope. This enterprise was doomed from the start, but we do what we can and what we must. So a young farmer with wife and children decides to go home. Good. He shows a sense which men like you and I will never understand. They will sing songs about us.
but he will ensure that there are people to sing them. He plants, we destroy. Anyway, he has played his part and fought like a man. It is criminal that he should feel the need to flee in shame.
Why not give them all the chance to go home? Asked Russ. Then you and I could stand on the walls and invite the Nadir to come at us one at a time, like sportsmen.
Suddenly Rex smiled, tension and anger flowing from him.
I won't argue with you, Drass, he said softly. You are a man I admire above all others. But in this I think you are wrong. Help yourself to wine. I shall be back soon.
Less than an hour later, the Earl's message was being read to all sections. Bregan brought the news to Gilad as he ate in the shade offered by the field hospital under the towering cliff face of West Carnia.
We can go home, said Bregan, his face flushed. We can be there by harvest supper.
I don't understand, said Gilad. Have we surrendered?
No. The Earl says that any who wish to leave can now do so. He says that we can leave with pride, that we have fought like men, and as men we must be given the right to go home.
Are we going to surrender? Asked Gilad, puzzled.
I don't think so, said Bregan.
Then I shall not go.
But the Earl says it's all right.
I don't care what he says.
I don't understand this, Gil. Lots of the others are going, and it is true that we've played our part, haven't we? I mean, we've done our best.
I suppose so. Gilad rubbed his tired eyes and turned to watch the smoke from the fire gully drift lazily skyward.
They did their best too, he whispered.
Who did?
Those who died. Those who are still going to die.
But the Earl says it's all right. He says that we can leave with our heads held high, proud.
Is that what he says?
Yes.
Well, my head wouldn't be high.
I don't understand you. I really don't. You have said all along that we can't hold this fortress. Now we have a chance to leave. Why can't you just accept it and come with us?
Because I'm a fool. Give my love to everyone back there.
You know I won't go unless you come too.
Don't you start being a fool, Breg. You've got everything to live for. Just picture little Legan toddling towards you, and all the stories you'll be able to tell. Go on, go.
No. I don't know why you're staying, but I shall stay too.
That you must not do, said Gilad gently. I want you to go back. I really do. After all, if you don't, there will be no one to tell them what a hero I am.
Seriously, Breg, I would feel so much better if I knew that you were away from all this. The Earl's right. Men like you have played their part magnificently, and as for me, well, I just want to stay here. I've learned so much about myself and about other men. I'm not needed anywhere but here. I'm not necessary. I will never be a farmer, and I have neither the money to be a businessman nor the breeding to be a prince. I'm a misfit. This is where I belong, with all the other misfits. Please, Bregan, please go.
There were tears in Bregan's eyes, and the two men embraced. Then the curly-haired young farmer rose.
I hope everything works out for you, Gil. I'll tell them all. I promise I will. Good luck.
And to you, farmer. Take your axe. They can hang it in the village hall.
Gilad watched him walk back towards the postern gates and the keep beyond. Bregan turned once and waved. Then he was gone. Altogether, 650 men chose to leave. 2,040 remained. Added to these were bowmen, Kaiser, and 50 archers. The other outlaws, having fulfilled their promise, returned to Skulkik.
Too damn few now, muttered Drass as the meeting ended.
I never liked crowds anyway, said Bowman lightly.
Hogan, Orin, Rek, and Serbitar remained in their seats as Drass and Bowman wandered out into the night.
Don't despair, old horse,
said Bowman, slapping Drass on the back.
Things could be worse, you know.
Really? How?
Well, we could be out of wine.
We are out of wine.
We are? That's terrible. I would never have stayed had I known. Luckily, however, I do just happen to have a couple of flagons of Lentrian Red stored in my new quarters, so at least we can enjoy tonight. We might even be able to save some for tomorrow.
That's a good idea, said Druss. Maybe we could bottle it and lay it down for a couple of months to age a little. Lentrian Red, my foot. That stuff of yours is brewed in Skultic from soap, potatoes and rat's entrails. You would get more taste from a Nadir slop bucket.
You have the advantage of me there, old horse, having never tasted a Nadir slop bucket. But my brew does hit the spot, rather.
I think I'd rather suck a Nadir's armpit, muttered Druss.
Fine, I'll drink it all myself, snapped Bowman.
No need to get touchy, boy. I'm with you. I have always believed that friends should suffer together.
The artery writhed under Virai's fingers like a snake spewing blood into the cavity of the stomach.
Tighter,
ordered Kalvar Sin, his own hands deep in the wound, pushing aside blue, slimy entrails as he sought frantically to stem the bleeding within. It was useless, he knew it was useless, but he owed it to the man beneath him to use every ounce of his skill. Despite all his efforts, he could feel the life oozing between his fingers. Another stitch, another small Pyrrhic victory. The man died as the 11th stitch sealed the stomach wall.
He's dead?
Asked Virai. Kalvar nodded, straightening his back.
But the blood is still flowing, she said.
It will do so for a few moments.
I really thought he would live, she whispered.
Kalvar wiped his bloody hands on a linen cloth and walked round beside her. He put his hands on her shoulders, turning her towards him. His chances were 1 in 1,000, even if I had stopped the bleeding. The lance cut his spleen, and gangrene was almost certain. Her eyes were red, her face grey. She blinked and her body shook, but there were no tears as she looked down at the dead face.
I thought he had a beard, she said, confused.
That was the one before.
Oh, yes. He died too.
You should rest. Putting his arms round her, he led her from the room and out into the ward, past the stacked rows of triple-tiered bunk beds. Orderlies moved quietly among the rows. Everywhere the smell of death and the sweet, nauseous odour of putrefaction was mixed with the antiseptic bitterness of laurasium juice and hot water scented with lemon mint. Perhaps it was the unwelcome perfume, but she was surprised to find that the well was not dry, and tears could still flow. He led her to a back room, filled a basin with warm water, and washed the blood from her hands and face, dabbing her gently as if she were a child.
"He told me that I love war," she said. "But it's not true. Maybe it was then. I don't know any more."
"Only a fool loves war," said Kalvar, "or a man who has never seen it. The trouble is that the survivors forget about the horrors and remember only the battle lust. They pass on that memory, and other men hunger for it. Put on your cloak and get some air, then you will feel better."
"I don't think I can come back tomorrow, Kalvar. I will stay with Rek at the wall."
"I understand."
"I feel so helpless, watching men die in here." She smiled. "I don't like feeling helpless. I'm not used to it."
He watched her from the doorway, her tall figure draped in a white cloak, the night breeze billowing her hair. "I feel helpless, too," he said softly. The last death had touched him more deeply than it should, but then he had known the man, whereas others were but nameless strangers. Garin, the former miller. Kalvar remembered that the man had a wife and son living at Delnok. "Well, at least someone will mourn for you, Garin," he whispered to the stars. Chapter 25. Rex sat and watched the stars shining high above the keep tower, and the passage of an occasional cloud, black against the moonlit sky. The clouds were like cliffs in the sky, jagged and threatening, inexorable and sentient. Rex pulled his gaze from the window and rubbed his eyes. He had known fatigue before, but never this soul-numbing weariness, this depression of the spirit. The room was dark now. He had forgotten to light the candles, so intent had he been on the darkening sky. He glanced about him. So open and welcoming during the hours of daylight, the room was now shadow-haunted and empty of life. He was an interloper. He drew his cloak about him. He missed Virai, but she was working at the field hospital with the exhausted Kalvar Sin. Nevertheless, the need in him was great, and he rose to go to her. Instead, he just stood there. Cursing, he lit the candles. Logs lay ready in the fireplace, so he lit the fire, though it was not cold, and sat in the firm leather chair, watching the small flames grow through the kindling and eat into the thicker logs above. The breeze fanned the flame, causing the shadows to dance, and Rex began to relax. "You fool," he said to himself as the flames roared and he began to sweat. He removed his cloak and boots and pulled the chair back from the blaze. A soft tap at the door roused Rex from his thoughts. He called out and Serbitar entered the room. For a moment Rex did not recognize him. He was without his armor, dressed in a tunic of green, his long white hair tied at the nape of the neck. "Am I disturbing you, Rex?" he said.
"Not at all. Sit down and join me."
"Thank you. Are you cold?"
"No. I just like to watch fires burn."
"I do, too. It helps me to think. A primal memory, perhaps, of a warm cave, and safety from predatory animals," said Serbitar.
"I wasn't alive then, despite my haggard appearance."
"But you were. The atoms that make up your body are as old as the universe."
"I have not the faintest idea what you're talking about, though I don't doubt that it is all true," said Rex.
An uneasy silence developed. Then both men spoke at once, and Rex laughed. Serbitar smiled and shrugged.
"I am unused to casual conversation. Unskilled."
"Most people are, when it comes down to it. It's an art," said Rex. "The thing to do is relax and enjoy the silences. That's what friends are all about. They are people with whom you can be silent."
"Truly?"
"My word of honour, as an earl."
"I'm glad to see you retain your humour. I would have thought it impossible to do so under the circumstances."
"Adaptability, my dear Serbitar. You can only spend so long thinking about death. Then it becomes boring. I have discovered that my great fear is not of dying, but of being a bore."
"You are seldom boring, my friend."
"Seldom? Never is the word I was looking for."
"I beg your pardon. Never is the word which I was, of course, seeking."
"How will tomorrow be?"
"I cannot say," answered Serbitar swiftly. "Where is the Lady Virai?"
"With Kalvar Sin. Half of the civilian nurses have fled south."
"You cannot blame them," said Serbitar.
He stood and walked to the window.
"The stars are bright tonight," he said, "though I suppose it would be more accurate to say that the angle of the earth makes visibility stronger."
"I think I prefer the stars are bright tonight," said Rex, who had joined Serbitar at the window. Below them, Virai was walking slowly, a white cloak wrapped about her shoulders and her long hair flowing in the night breeze.
"I think I will join her, if you'll excuse me," said Rex. Serbitar smiled. "Of course. I will sit by the fire and think, if I may."
"Make yourself at home," said Rex, pulling on his boots. Moments after Rex had left, Vintar entered. He too had forsaken armor for a simple tunic of white wool, hooded and thick.
"That was painful for you, Serbitar,"
"You should have allowed me to come," he said, patting the younger man's shoulder. "I could not tell him the truth."
"But you did not lie," whispered Winter.
"When does evasion of the truth become a lie?"
"I do not know. But you brought them together, and that was your purpose. They have this night."
"Should I have told him?"
"No. He would have sought to alter that which cannot be altered."
"Cannot or must not?" asked Surbiter.
"Cannot. He could order her not to fight tomorrow, and she would refuse. He cannot lock her away. She is an earl's daughter."
"If we told her,
she would refuse to accept it, or else defy fate."
"Then she is doomed."
"No. She is merely going to die."
"I will do everything in my power to protect her, Winter. You know that."
"As will I. But we will fail. Tomorrow night, you must show the Earl Egil's secret."
"He will be in no mood to see it."
Rek put his arm about her shoulders, leaned forward and kissed her cheek.
"I love you," he whispered.
She smiled and leaned into him, saying nothing.
"I simply can't say it," said Virai, her large eyes turned full upon him.
"That's all right. Do you feel it? You know that I do.
I just find it hard to say. Romantic words sound strange, clumsy when I use them. It's as if my throat wasn't made to form the sounds. I feel foolish. Do you understand what I am saying?"
He nodded and kissed her again.
"And anyway, I haven't had your practice."
"True," he said.
"What does that mean?" she snapped. "I was just agreeing with you."
"Well, don't. I'm in no mood for humour.
It's easy for you. You're a talker, a storyteller. Your conceit carries you on. I want to say all the things I feel, but I cannot. And then, when you say them first, my throat just seizes up, and I know I should say something, but I still can't."
"Listen, lovely lady. It doesn't matter. They are just words, as you say. I'm good with words. You're good with actions. I know that you love me. I don't expect you to echo me every time I tell you how I feel. I was just thinking earlier about something Horeb told me years ago. He said that for every man there is the one woman, and that I would know mine when I saw her. And I do." "When I saw you," she said, turning into him and hugging his waist, "I thought you were a popinjay."
She laughed.
"You should have seen your face as that outlaw charged towards you."
"I was concentrating. I've told you before that marksmanship was never my strong point.
You were petrified."
"True. But you still rescued me."
"True. I'm a natural hero."
"No, you're not. And that's why I love you. You're just a man who does his best and tries to be honorable. That is rare."
"Despite my conceit, and you may find this hard to believe, I get very uncomfortable when faced with compliments.
But I want to say what I feel. It's important to me. You are the first man I ever really felt comfortable with as a woman. You brought me to life. I may die during this siege, but I want you to know that it has been worth it."
"Don't talk about dying. Look at the stars. Feel the night. It's beautiful, isn't it?"
"Yes, it is. Why don't you take me back to the keep, and then I can show you how actions speak louder than words."
"Why don't I just do that?"
They made love without passion, but gently, lovingly, and fell asleep watching the stars through the bedroom window. The Nadir captain, Ogasi, urged his men on, baying the war chant of Ulrich's wolf's head tribe and smashing his axe into the face of a tall defender. The man's hand scrabbled at the wound as he fell back. The hideous battle song carried them forward, cleaving the ranks and gaining a foothold on the grass beyond. But as always, Deathwalker and the White Templars rallied the defenders. Orgas's hatred gave him power as he cut left and right, trying to force his way towards the old man. A sword cut his brow and he staggered momentarily, recovering to disembowel the swordsman. On the left the line was being pushed back, but on the right it was sweeping out like the horn of a bull. The powerful Nadir wanted to scream his triumph to the skies. At last they had them! But again the Draenei rallied, pushing himself back into the throng in order to wipe away the blood from his eyes. Agassi watched the tall Draenei and his sword maiden block the horn as it swung. Leading maybe 20 warriors, the tall man in the silver breastplate and blue cape seemed to have gone mad. His laughter sang out over the Nadir chant, and men fell back before him. His berserk rage carried him deep among the tribesmen, and he used no defense. His red-drenched sword blade sliced, hammered, and cut into their ranks. Beside him the woman ducked and parried, protecting his left, her own slender blade every bit as deadly. Slowly the horn collapsed in upon itself, and Agassi found himself being drawn back to the battlements. He tripped over the body of a Draenei archer who was still clutching his bow. Kneeling, Agassi dragged it from the dead hand and pulled a black-shafted arrow from the quiver. Leaping lightly to the battlements, he strained for sight of Deathwalker, but the old man was at the center and obscured by Nadir bodies. Not so the tall berserker. Men were scattering before him. Agassi notched the arrow to the string, drew, aimed, and with a whispered curse let fly. The shaft skinned Rek's forearm and flew on. Virai turned, seeking Rek, and the shaft punched through her mail shirt to bury itself below her right breast. She grunted at the impact, staggered and half fell. A Nadir warrior broke through the line, racing towards her. Gritting her teeth, she drew herself upright, blocked his wild attack, and opened his jugular with a backhand cut. "Rek!" she called, panic welling within her as her lungs began to bubble, absorbing the arterial blood. But he could not hear her. Pain erupted, and she fell, twisting her body away from the arrow so as not to drive it deeper. Servitar ran to her side, lifting her head. "Damn," she said, "I'm dying." He touched her hand, and immediately the pain vanished. "Thank you, friend. Where's Rek?" "He is berserk, Virai. I could not reach him now." "Oh, gods, listen to me. Don't let him be alone for a while after. You know, he is a great romantic fool, and I think he might do something silly. You understand?" "I understand. I will stay with him." "No, not you. Send Dras. He is older, and Rek worships him." She turned her eyes to the sky. A solitary storm cloud floated there, lost and angry. "He warned me to wear a breastplate, but it's so damned heavy." The cloud seemed larger now. She tried to mention it to Servitar, but the cloud loomed and the darkness engulfed her. Rek stood at the balcony window, gripping the rail, tears streaming from his eyes, and uncontrollable sobs bursting through gritted teeth. Behind him lay Virai, still, cold, and at peace. Her face was white, her breast red from the arrow wound, which had pierced a lung. The blood had stopped flowing now. Shuddering breaths filled Rek's lungs as he fought to control his grief. Blood dripped from a forgotten wound in his forearm. He rubbed his eyes and turned back to the bed. Sitting beside her, he lifted her arm and felt for a pulse, but there was nothing. "Virai," he said softly, "come back. Come back. Listen, I love you. You're the one." He leaned over her, watching her face. A tear appeared there, then another. But they were his own. He lifted her head and cradled it in his arms. "Wait for me,"
he whispered. I'm coming.
He fumbled at his belt, pulling the Lentrian dagger from its sheath, and held it to his wrist.
Put it down, boy, said Druss from the doorway. It would be meaningless.
Get out, shouted Rek. Leave me.
She's gone, lad. Cover her.
Cover her? Cover my Virai? No, no, I can't. Oh, gods, it, Misael, I can't just cover her face.
I had to once,
said the old man, as Rek slumped forward, tears stinging his eyes and silent sobs racking his frame.
My woman died. You are not the only one to face death.
For a long while, Druss stood silently in the doorway, his heart aching. Then he pushed the door shut and walked into the room.
Leave her for a while and talk to me, boy, he said, taking Rek by the arm. Here, by the window. Tell me again how you met.
And Rek told him of the attack in the forest, the killing of Reynard, the ride to the temple, and the journey to Delnok.
Druss?
Yes. I don't think I can live with this. I have known men who couldn't. But there is no need to cut your wrists. There's a horde of tribesmen out here who will do it for you, gladly.
I don't care about them anymore. They can have the damn place. I wish I had never come here.
I know, said Druss gently. I spoke to Virai yesterday in the hospital. She told me she loved you. She said,
I don't want to hear it.
Yes, you do, because it's a memory you can hold, and it keeps her alive in your mind. She said that if she died, it would be worth it just to have met you. She worshipped you, Rek. She told me of the day you stood by her against Reynard and all his men. She was so proud of you. I was, too, when I heard about it. You had something, boy, that few men ever possess.
And now I've lost it.
But you had it. That can never be taken away from you. Her only regret was she was never really able to tell you how she felt.
Oh, she told me. It didn't need words. What happened to you when your wife died? How did it feel?
I don't think I need to tell you. You know how I felt. And don't think it's any easier after 30 years. If anything, it becomes harder. Now, Serbitar is waiting to see you in the hall. He says it's important.
Nothing is important anymore.
Just, will you cover her face?
I couldn't bear to do it.
Yes. Then you must see the albino. He has something for you.
Serbitar was waiting at the bottom of the stairs as Rek slowly descended to the main hall. The albino wore full armor and helm topped with white horsehair. The visor was down, shielding his eyes. He looked, Rek thought, like a silver statue. Only his hands were bare, and these were white as polished ivory.
You wanted me, said Rek.
Follow me, said Serbitar. Turning on his heel, he strode from the hall towards the spiral stone stairwell leading to the dungeons below the keep. Rek had been ready to refuse any request, but now he was forced to follow, and his anger grew. The albino stopped at the top of the stairs and removed a flaming torch from a copper wall bracket.
Where are we going? Asked Rek.
Follow me, repeated Serbitar. Slowly and carefully, the two men descended the cracked, worn steps, until at last they reached the first level of dungeons. Long disused, the hallway glittered with water-sodden cobwebs and wet, moss-covered arches. Serbitar moved on until they reached an oak door, a rusty bolt holding it fast. He struggled with the bolt for some moments, finally working it free. Then both men had to haul on the door before it creaked and groaned and opened. Another stairwell beyond yawned dark before them. Once again Serbitar started down. The steps ended in a long corridor, ankle-deep in water. They waded through to a final door, shaped like an oak leaf, and bearing a gold plaque with inscribed lettering in the elder tongue.
"What does it say?"
asked Rek.
"It says, 'To the worthy welcome, herein lies Aegil's secret, and the soul of the Earl of Bronze.'
What does it mean?" Serbitar tried the door handle, but the door was locked, seemingly from within, since no bolt, chain, or keyhole could be seen.
"Do we break it down?" said Rek.
"No. You open it."
"It is locked. Is this a game?"
"Try it." Rek turned the handle gently, and the door swung open without a sound. Soft lights sprang up within the room, glowing globes of glass set in the recesses of the walls. The room was dry, though now the water from the corridor outside flowed in and spread across the richly carpeted floor. At the center of the room, on a wooden stand, was a suit of armor unlike anything Rek had ever seen. It was wonderfully crafted in bronze, the overlapping scales of metal glittering in the light. The breastplate carried a bronze eagle, with wings flaring out over the chest and up to the shoulders. Atop this was a helmet, winged and crested with an eagle's head. Gauntlets there were, scaled and hinged, and greaves. Upon the table before the armor lay a bronze-ringed mail shirt, lined with softest leather, and mail leggings with bronze-hinged kneecaps. But above all, Rek was drawn to the sword, encased in a block of solid crystal. The blade was golden and over 2 feet in length, the hilt double-handed, the guard a pair of flaring wings.
"It is the armor of Aegil, the first Earl of Bronze," said Serbitar.
"Why was it allowed to lie here?"
"No one could open the door," answered the albino.
"It was not locked," said Rek.
"Not to you."
"What does that mean?"
"The meaning is clear. You, and no other, were meant to open the door."
"I can't believe that."
"Shall I fetch you the sword?" asked Serbitar.
"If you wish." Serbitar walked to the crystal cube, drew his own sword, and hammered at the block. Nothing happened. His blade clanged back into the air, leaving no mark upon the crystal.
"You try," said Serbitar.
"May I borrow your sword?"
"Just reach for the hilt."
Rek moved forward and lowered his hand to the crystal, waiting for the cold touch of glass, which never came. His hand sank into the block, his fingers curling round the hilt. Effortlessly, he drew the blade forth.
"Is it a trick?" he asked. "Probably. But it is none of mine. Look."
The albino put his hands on the now empty crystal and heaved himself up upon it.
"Pass your hands below me," he said.
Rek obeyed. For him, the crystal did not exist.
"What does it mean?"
"I do not know, my friend. Truly, I do not."
"Then how did you know it was here?"
"That is even more difficult to explain.
Do you remember that day in the grove when I could not be awakened?"
"Yes."
"Well, I travelled far across the planet, and even beyond, but in my travels I breasted the currents of time, and I visited Delnok. It was night, and I saw myself leading you through the hall and down to this room. I saw you take the sword, and I heard you ask the question you have just asked. And then I heard my answer."
"So, at this moment, are you hovering above us, listening?"
"Yes."
"I know you well enough to believe you, but answer me this. That may explain how you are here now with me, but how did the first Serbitar know the armor was here?"
I genuinely cannot explain it, Rick. It is like looking into the reflection of a mirror and watching it go on and on into infinity. But I have found in my studies that often there is more to this life than we reckon with. Meaning? There is the power of the source. I am in no mood for religion. Then let us instead say that all those centuries ago, Eagle looked into the future and saw this invasion, so he left his armor here, guarded by magic which only you, as the Earl, could break. Is your spirit image still observing us? Yes. Does it know of my loss? Yes. Then you knew she would die? Yes. Why did you not tell me? It would have been a waste of joy. What does that mean? Said Rek, anger building inside him and pushing away the grief. It means that were you a farmer, anticipating long life, I might have warned you, to prepare you. But you are not. You are fighting a savage horde, and your life is at risk every day. As was Virai's. You knew that she might die. Had I told you this was certain, not only would it have gained you nothing, but also robbed you of the joy you had.
I could have saved her.
No, you could not.
I don't believe that.
Why would I lie? Why would I wish her dead?
Rek did not answer. The word dead entered his heart and crushed his soul. Tears welled in him again, and he fought them back, concentrating on the armor.
I will wear that tomorrow, he said through gritted teeth. I will wear it and die.
Perhaps, answered the albino.
Chapter 26. The dawn was clear, the air fresh and sweet, as 2,000 Draenei warriors prepared for the assault on Khania. Below them, the Nadir shaman was moving through the ranks of tribesmen, sprinkling the blood of chickens and sheep on the bared blades which the warriors held before them. Then the Nadir massed, and a great swelling chant came from thousands of throats as the horde moved forward, bearing ladders, knotted ropes, and grappling irons. Rek watched from the center of the line. He lifted the bronze helm and placed it over his head, buckling the chin strap. To his left was Serbitar, to his right Menahem. Others of the 30 were spread along the wall. And the carnage began. Three assaults were turned back before the Nadir gained a foothold on the battlements. And this was short-lived. Some 20 tribesmen breached the defense, only to find themselves faced with a madman in bronze and 2 silver ghosts who strode among them dealing death. There was no defense against these men, and the bronze devil's sword could cut through any shield or armor. Men died under that terrible blade, screaming as if their souls were ablaze. That night, the Nadir captains carried their reports to the tent of Ulrich, and the talk was all of the new force upon the battlements. Even the legendary Druss seemed more human, laughing as he did in the face of Nadir swords, than this golden machine of destruction. We felt like dogs being beaten from his path with a stick, muttered one man, or weaponless children being thrust aside by an elder. Ulrich was troubled, and, though he lifted their spirits at last by pointing out again and again that it was merely a man in bronze armor, after the captains had left, he summoned the ancient shaman Nostr Khan to his tent. Squatting before a blazing brazier of coals, the old man listened to his warlord, nodding the while. At last he bowed and closed his eyes. Rek was asleep, exhausted by battle and sorrow. The nightmare came slowly, enveloping him like black smoke. His dream eyes opened, and before him was a cave mouth, black and terrible. Fear emanated from it like a tangible force. Behind him was a pit, stretching down into the fiery bowels of the earth, from which came strange sounds, whimpers and screams. In his hand was no sword, upon his body no armour. A slithering sound came from the pit, and Rek turned to see, oozing up from it, a gigantic worm, slime-covered and putrescent. The stench made him reel back. The mouth of the worm was huge and could swallow a man with ease. Around it were triple rows of pointed fangs, and lodged between one set was the arm of a man, bloody and broken. Rek backed towards the cave mouth, but a hissing made him spin round. From the blackness of the cave came a spider, its giant maw dripping poison. Within its mouth was a face, green and shimmering, and from the mouth of the face flowed words of power. As each word sounded, Rek grew weaker, until he could hardly stand.
"Are you just going to stand there all day?" said a voice. Rek turned to see Virai, by his side, dressed in a flowing gown of white. She smiled at him. "You're back," he said, reaching out for her. "No time for that, you fool. Here, take your sword."
Her arms reached towards him, and the bronze sword of Egil appeared in her hands. A shadow fell across them as Rek snatched the sword, spinning round to face the worm, which was towering above them. The blade swept through 3 feet of the creature's neck as the mouth descended, and green gore spouted from the wound. Rek struck again and again, until the creature, almost cut in two, flopped backwards into the pit.
"The spider!"
yelled Virai, and he spun once more. The beast was upon him, its huge mouth mere paces away. Rek hurled his sword into the gaping maw, and it flew like an arrow to split the green face within like a melon. The spider reared into the air and toppled backwards. A breeze blew up, and the beast became black smoke, which drifted into the air and then was gone.
"I suppose you would have gone on standing there if I hadn't come along," said Virai.
"I think so," answered Rek.
"You fool,"
she said, smiling, and he moved forward tentatively, holding out his arms.
"Can I touch you?"
he asked.
"An odd request for a husband to make."
"You won't disappear?" Her smile faded.
"Not yet, my love."
His arms crushed her to him, tears spilling from his eyes.
"I thought you were gone forever. I thought I would never see you again."
For a while they said nothing, but merely stood together, embracing. Finally, she gently pushed him away.
"You must go back," she said.
"Back?"
"To Delnok. You are needed there."
"I need you more than I need Delnok. Can we not stay here, together?"
"No. There is no here. It doesn't exist. Only you and I are real. Now you must return."
"I will see you again, won't I?"
"I love you, Rek. I will always love you."
He awoke with a start, eyes focusing on the stars outside his window. Her face could still be seen, fading against the midnight sky.
"Virai!"
he shouted.
"Virai!"
The door opened and Servitar ran to the bedside.
"Rek, you're dreaming. Wake up."
"I am awake. I saw her. She came to me in a dream and rescued me."
"All right. But she's gone now. Look at me."
Rek gazed into Servitar's green eyes. He saw concern there, but this soon faded, and the albino smiled.
"You're all right," said Servitar. "Tell me of the dream."
Afterwards, Servitar questioned him about the face. He wanted every detail that could be remembered. Finally, he smiled.
"I think you were the victim of Nostra Khan," he said. "But you held him off. A rare feat, Rek."
"Virai came to me. It was not a dream?"
"I think not. The source released her for a time."
"I would like to believe that. I truly would."
"I think you should. Have you looked for your sword?"
Rek swung out of the bed and padded over to the table where his armor lay. The sword was gone.
How? Whispered Rek. Serbitar shrugged. It will return, never fear.
Serbitar lit the candles and stoked the fire to life in the hearth. As he finished, a gentle tapping came at the door.
Come in,
called Rek. A young officer entered, bearing the sword of Eagle.
I am sorry to disturb you, sir, but I saw the light. One of the sentries found your sword upon the Khania battlements, so I brought it here. I wiped the blood from it first, sir.
Blood?
Yes, sir. It was covered in blood.
Strange how wet it still was.
Thank you again.
Rek turned to Serbitar. I don't understand. In the tent of Ulrich, the candles flickered. The warlord sat transfixed, staring at the headless body on the floor before him. The sight was one which would haunt him for the rest of his days. One moment the shaman had been sitting in trance before the coals, the next a red line had been drawn across his neck, and his head toppled into the fire.